Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
The early days of adolescence are complicated in the best of circumstances. You're getting old enough to observe the strange things adults do, but you don't yet have the context to understand them. And you're trying to decide for yourself, who are you exactly, and where do you belong? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In Veera Hiranandani's new novel for young readers, 12-year-old Nisha is dealing with these questions as the daughter of a Hindu father and a Muslim mother who died when she was born. And she's considering them at a cataclysmic moment in history, the 1947 partition of India into two countries upon liberation from British colonial rule. She, her twin brother Emil, her father and grandmother have been living in what will become Pakistan, which forces them to leave the only home she's ever known, to make the dangerous border crossing into the new India. It's a baffling, frightening, and exhilarating journey. Veera Hiranandani teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence. Her novel is called The Night Diary, and she joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Veera, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is such an interesting decision to make your protagonist 12 years old because we sort of live through her confusion. She's old enough to know what's happening, but not necessarily old enough to be able to understand it.
Sure. Well, I think that for me, I find it's almost easier to put myself in a 12-year-old's point of view than almost any other age. And I think that it has to do with the fact that for me during that time, and for many, many people in that middle school age, it was a really vivid time for me. It was a time when my world sort of broke open a bit, and I kind of realized that it was a lot more complicated than I thought. So I think for when I was thinking about writing about partition, I knew I wanted to write for young people, but then, of course, you have to make the decision of what age your main character is going to be. And 12 is just kind of a sweet spot for me because you still carry that innocence of childhood. You're not quite a teenager. And yet you really are able to start to understand the world in very complex ways, probably more complex than most adults think you can.
Yeah. Duality reverberates throughout this story in a lot of different ways. Nisha is a twin. Her twin brother is very different from her, but he's also, in an important way, a part of her. She's being raised by a Hindu father in a Muslim city. It's a place where she feels at home and then is made a stranger by forces beyond her control. My understanding is that you felt a kind of duality in your own upbringing.
Yes, I did. I also have a Hindu father who was born in India, who had to leave his home during partition, which is a huge reason why I wanted to shape a story around this time, because I had grown up hearing stories of partition in bits and pieces when I was young, and only fully understood it or tried to fully understand it as I got older. And then my mother was born in this country, in Brooklyn, Jewish, and my mother and father met in Poughkeepsie, of all places. So I like telling that story. You know, my father was born in what is now Pakistan. My mom was born in Brooklyn. They met in Poughkeepsie. So I felt, and I grew up in a small town in Connecticut. And when I was young, I went to a very, I went to a small private school, very arts-based. We had like 8 kids in a classroom. I was with the same kids for many years in a row, very accepting. And I had no idea that my background was different. It was just me, and then there were the other kids in the class, and they had their backgrounds. And it wasn't an incredibly diverse group of kids necessarily, but it just, I didn't stand out in any way. I was just part of this family. And then in 5th grade, I went to a large public school in the 80s in Connecticut, and suddenly I was treated very differently, and nobody could pronounce my name when they would ask, and I would try to talk about my background. A lot of people weren't familiar with what it meant to be half Indian, to be Jewish and Hindu, to be all the things that I was carrying. And some kids made fun of me. Some kids just didn't understand. I definitely suddenly felt very other. And I was completely floored because I had no idea that I was or would be seen that way by anybody else. So that was something to grapple with. And eventually I found my way. But it was a difficult journey, nowhere near as difficult as Nisha's journey, certainly, in the book.
I'm curious about whether your father's experience of the partition was a story you grew up with. You said you learned about it in bits and pieces. Was it sort of always part of the family lore, or was it a fact that you just asked to be explained as time went on?
It was part of the family lore. But at the same time, you know, my father was young. He was nine. And once in a while, I would hear him talk about it. I always knew that this had happened to his family, my aunts and uncles, my grandparents, who I never met because they died before I was born. But I always knew that they had to leave, and they had to leave quickly. And they basically packed a few bags and got on a train and never returned to their original home. And it was sad and it was scary. And then they started a new life, and they were really one of the lucky ones because they made it safely. They were alive and they had a chance to start over. I'm sure the loss was much greater for my grandparents, in the sense, because my father was so young, he was just kind of told what to do and trusted that he would be kept safe, and he was. So he, I'm sure, had the experience of when he was growing up, realizing what he had been through, how dangerous it actually had been. And so I would hear that that's what happened to his family and the general story. I didn't understand the magnitude of the history until I actually saw the movie Gandhi when I was 11. And it was, we went as a family, and it was the first time that I had seen partition portrayed anywhere else outside of my family. I didn't learn about it at school. Nobody else outside of my family talked about it. And I couldn't believe, first of all, what had happened and on the scale that it happened. So that was the first time at 11 I was trying to really process this history, and, you know, how many people died. 14 million people, or over 14 million people, migrated. 1 to 2 million people died. The amount of the cycle of violence that erupted is just, it's nobody can really understand it, no matter how much time you spend researching and thinking about this history. But it raised these questions, and I really had this feeling like this is what you went through. This is the partition you've been talking about. This is the same thing that I'm connected to. So it imprinted something in me that I never forgot. And then I started asking more questions. And then as an adult, I did more formal research. It took me many years to sort of become brave enough to think that I could create a story around this piece of history.
I really like the character of Nisha's father, who I think especially to young readers seems a little distant and harsh. I think maybe parents may have a broader perspective on him. But what feels, I think, through her eyes like a kind of disinterest is revealed to be something different. He's preoccupied with this enormous change that's coming that in some ways he's been able to shelter his kids from until the very last minute.
Yes, and I think that there are a lot of things in that character. I can see this story from both a child's point of view, because I was one, and I can also see it from a parent's point of view, because I'm a parent now, and some of the decisions that I might make to keep my kids safe sometimes aren't always the best choices. I think that as adults and as parents, a lot of times we want to keep the world innocent for our children and not let them know the horrors in many different forms all around us. But sometimes things leak out. Kids find out stuff anyway. And then, of course, nowadays it's a very different world with the access of information that kids have. But when you know that something's being kept from you that is difficult, I think you only become more curious. And also that mystery can almost feel more frightening. So it's always that balance of how much to share with your children. And I think the character of Papa was really struggling with that. He was also somebody who is, you know, his wife died when his children were born. He certainly didn't expect that. He is still grieving 12 years later. And he's very focused on work and just moving forward and making sure his kids are safe and well taken care of. So they all have to confront a new version of themselves when their lives turn upside down, as many people do when they face a crisis.
So Nisha does have someone in her life who is really nurturing, and that is Kazi. Tell us about him.
Yes. So Kazi, I'm not sure in some ways where Kazi ultimately came from. You know, when I think of Papa, I think, well, he's kind of inspired a bit like my father was when I was growing up, and the imagined grandfather that I never met, and then, of course, just something completely fictional. Kazi was just maybe this other father figure and a friend to Nisha in a way that she can't find this connection anywhere else. There's nobody else that really takes the time to see her and understand her, other than her brother, but it's different. It's sort of like they're almost too close.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this outside person who really sees her for what she is, understands how great she is, how wonderful she is, even though she can't always express that, and then teaches her a way to express herself because he's the family cook and she is drawn to cooking. And they cook together, and he shares that with her, and it's a way for her to express herself because she's very shy. She has trouble speaking to anybody outside of her family. So he really gives her something that's actually very empowering for her. And I wanted her to have that.
I was thinking, you know, in these wonderful scenes where you go into detail about what they're cooking, even when it's pretty simple, you know, everyday food, this is not only a link for Nisha to both of the cultures that she's inherited. I mean, it's ultimately a link for the people who, until the partition, have lived peacefully together in this community.
Yes. Well, you know, this area that they are living in before they have to leave is called Sindh. And so there are a lot of combinations of influences in the food there. So some of it is more kind of what we think of as northern Indian food. And some of it's just very based on that area of Pakistan, Sindh. One dish that has been passed down in my family, and I mention in the book, is Sai Bhaji, which is this spinach dish. And it is the one recipe I have that was probably originally my grandmother's recipe that I always know originated in Sindh. And I think food has always been very important to me in the sense that it's helped me bridge both my cultures and my family. So I always say that samosas and chicken matzo ball soup are my favorite comfort foods. And I really grew up eating a lot of Indian food and a lot of traditional Jewish foods. And it was, I felt like I enjoyed cooking, and it was an easy way for me to feel comfortable, to feel that I belonged to one culture or another. Like, I know what this is. I know how to make it. I know what it tastes like. I know the name of it. And I didn't always feel that about a lot of other things. Often, I think when you have a mixed background, you're wondering, sort of, you tend to sometimes feel like
I have to jump in and take
enough.
A break here. I'm sorry, Vera. Oh. My guest is Vera Hiranandani. We're talking about her new novel, The Night Diary. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Vera Hiranandani, who teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence and has a new novel out for young readers called The Night Diary. It tells the story of a 12-year-old girl and her twin brother at the time of the partition of India. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Vera, this story is narrated by Nisha in the form of letters that she writes to her late mother in her diary. And as we've mentioned, her mother died during childbirth, so it's not someone that she knew. And there's so much poignance here because she's imagining this person who might sort of fill all the gaps of her life, like everything that's not quite right would be different if her mother were there. And yet she asks over and over as she's writing these letters to her mother, do you care about this? Are you watching from wherever you are? Are you paying attention?
Yeah, I felt like she would at this time. You know, she had never had a diary before. And actually, when I started writing this book, I knew I wanted to have her mother not there. I wanted her to have that loss and sort of thinking about that and thinking about what would happen if her mother was alive, having a Muslim mother and a Hindu father during this time. And so originally I had her writing in a diary to herself, and something wasn't driving it. It didn't feel grounded. And then I realized, oh, of course, she's writing to her mother. So I wrote a lot of the novel without that. And then once I added that, it felt like it gave me a focus for her in the way that she's really creating the mother that she needs to have now, the mother she'll never know. But also, you know, it's a way for her to really, I think it's still sort of writing to herself, but it kind of gives her that cover a little bit.
Another way that you bring duality into this story is that we as readers come to know Nisha and her brother Emil as really smart people, fully formed human beings. They have complex emotions and talents. Based on the way that you describe them, Nisha sometimes can barely bring herself to speak. Sounds a little bit like somebody that has something like selective mutism. Emil struggles to read because the letters jump around on the page, which sounds a little bit like dyslexia. And I was thinking about the fact that they might be reduced to only those challenges by people who don't take the time to know them well, but they are so much more than those things.
Yes. So I think you're exactly right in the sense that I wanted the reader to kind of fill in that impression that it sounds something like those things. And maybe it is and maybe it isn't. But first, you know, for any kind of learning difference, it's sort of different for every person who experiences that. And at the same time, in 1947, the idea of having something like dyslexia would maybe have just translated into the way Papa believes Emil's just not trying hard enough. He doesn't fully understand what is wrong with him in that way. And so I wanted to give it the feeling of what it might have been like at that time to have a learning difference. So there was a reason why I didn't label it specifically, and I wanted the reader to just kind of fill in whatever that felt like, whatever felt right for them. Nisha could just be extremely shy. You're not sure exactly what's going on with Emil, but at the same time, I'm very interested for a number of different personal reasons how people are treated when they do feel other in whatever way that is. It's amazing to me that it can make such a difference, especially when you're young, if you're just not completely with the majority in whatever way, and that can play out in so many specific differences. So it could be about race, it could be about religion, it could be about your learning style. And I still don't know, you know, why it is so hard for people who, you don't even have to be that sort of outside the majority to very quickly be looked at as somebody much more different than you feel inside.
And of course, there's the reality that you can look like everybody else to everybody else and still feel different.
Exactly. So a lot of people are navigating multiple identities. I mean, Nisha is navigating this in a very direct way because her country's being split apart and both of her identities are literally sort of being split into two groups, and one group is supposed to go here and one group is supposed to go there. And if you're carrying those two identities, where do you belong? But I think we all carry multiple identities. Sometimes it could be as simple as, you know, you're an artsy kid and your parents are accountants and you just feel really different in your family or with your friends. You like this kind of music and everybody else likes that kind of music. I mean, there can be just these small things, or, of course, much more emotional, deeper things that people struggle with. And so I think that this is a very loud way to explain that in the book, but I hope that kids can bring whatever feelings they have, whatever bridges they're trying to make in their lives to the experience of Nisha and relate to her that way.
When you moved to the bigger public school from a smaller private school, and you were, you know, for the first time confronted with the fact that there was something unusual about your identity, you weren't just Vera. Did your name cause people to place you more in like an Indian category than a Jewish one, as if they needed to be mutually exclusive?
Right. It's interesting because one, you know, is more racial, more ethnic, my ethnicity in that sense, and one's about religion. So I think it was easier. I have dark hair and my name is Vera Hiranandani. So I think that in some ways that was an easier category for people to kind of put me in a way. But at the same time, and then when I would say, but I'm, you know, my mother's Jewish. And so I was brought up Jew-ish, as I like to say. My parents were very secular. I think that they felt like it would be less confusing to sort of put religion aside other than some holidays that we celebrated. But in some ways, it made it more confusing. And I had to ask a lot of questions on my own. So I think when people would find out, you know, my name is Vera Hiranandani and I'm half Indian and I'm also Jewish, I think a lot of people just didn't know what to do with that. And there weren't very many Jewish kids in my class, and there weren't very many Indian kids. So a half Indian Jewish kid, I mean, no, that was it. I was the only one for miles and miles. So yeah, it was definitely confusing, but I'm really grateful for having to ask maybe more questions than the average kid who felt a little more comfortable in what group they belonged. And not, you know, most 12-year-olds don't feel particularly comfortable even if they act like it. But I really didn't, and I was very aware that I didn't. But it allowed me to really empathize for people who do feel other in any way. It allowed me to really examine why that was and why it was so hard and confusing for people around me. And so it really has become my muse. It's a question that I continue to ask myself in all of my writing in all different ways. And I'm really grateful to have that point of view.
I mean, it's a really interesting and useful attribute for a novelist, surely. I'm always interested in people who have to navigate an identity that the rest of the world puts on them, whether it fits perfectly or not.
Yeah, I know. I think that certainly when I would spend time with the Indian side of my family, there was almost, and then at the same time when I would spend time with the Jewish side of my family, my cousins, all, most of them had either two Indian parents and two Hindu parents or two Jewish parents, and they were doing more traditional things, and I felt like I was never enough of one or the other. So even in the categories that I was supposed to fit in, I felt like I didn't fit. And that was why it took me a while to sort of gain the courage to write this book, because I felt like, am I Indian enough to be able to write this book? And I don't think I would have if my father hadn't experienced partition. I couldn't talk to him directly about that experience and feel that direct connection. But at the same time, you know, I'm a half Indian Jewish girl who grew up in Connecticut. So there's, you know, I didn't experience things myself. And would I be sort of, did I have the right to tell this story? And I was sharing that with my mom. And, you know, I said, I don't know if I can really do this justice, but I can't stop thinking about it. Mm. I really feel like it's a story that hasn't been told in, certainly for kids often in this country. And I think it's important for people to know it's such a huge piece of history. But I'm not a historian. I wasn't even that great a history student. Can I really do this? And she sent me a quote from E.L. Doctorow, and I may not be saying it exactly right, but the quote said, "It's the historian's job to tell what happened, and it's the novelist's job to tell what it felt like."
Hmm.
And for me, that gave me the courage that once I researched the history and had the foundation of all the proper names and dates, and then talked to my father about the setting and his house and the landscape, I read a lot of personal testimonies of what it felt like to go through this time, people going in both directions, hundreds of them, and not only used my father's experience, but tried to combine many different experiences to create one possible journey. And that was the way I could access it.
My guest is novelist Veera Hiranandani. Her new book for young readers is called The Night Diary. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So Veera, Nisha's father explains to her that Gandhi believes that Indians could have remained one people. He had this sort of vision of peaceful religious pluralism. Nisha is really taken with Gandhi, and I hate that we know as readers, at least the adults who are reading this book, we know what she doesn't, that, you know, a few months after these events, he will be assassinated.
Yeah. And I remember watching the movie Gandhi and being so heartbroken about that. And now as an adult.
You didn't know when you turned on the movie the first time as a kid.
I don't know. You know, it's funny that you say that. I can't remember. I remember being completely shocked. I remember playing that scene over and over in my head where I think he says, "Oh God," when he gets shot. And I was just devastated by it in the movie, of the way Gandhi is portrayed in the movie. And that was really my idea of Gandhi growing up. Now, of course, as an adult doing more research, Gandhi was also a complicated person and a flawed person. And I, you know, in my research, I found some things that have disappointed me about Gandhi. And lo and behold, he was also a human being. But as everybody was, and all the political leaders playing a part in this piece. But that was the thing that I didn't really want to discuss. There is a lot of great nonfiction history written about all the political forces at work during this time. So it really was about a girl. What would a girl living a very ordinary life? You know, she lives with her father and her grandmother, and she wonders what's for dinner, and she wishes she had more friends, and then her world turns upside down. So what would she feel like? How would she look at Gandhi and Jinnah and Nehru and the British Empire and Lord Mountbatten and all these people that were playing a part? What would she even know about them? You know, that was something I had to spend a lot of time thinking about. How would she find out? What headlines would she see? What would her father tell her? And I really just try to imagine myself at that age, the way you find out things in these bits and pieces, and then kind of certain things stick with you, certain things don't, and certain things seem completely absurd to you. Like, why why are we doing this? What is the point of all of this? I was living in this community peacefully 4 weeks ago, and now suddenly people are fearful of each other and have mistrust, and I'm supposed to not like my neighbors, and it makes absolutely no sense to me. And so I really wanted her to ask that question without sort of the influence of what side she was supposed to be on.
Yeah, the thing is, we're reminded in reading this that that is still a valid question. Like, it is ridiculous that you know, formerly peaceful communities devolve into violence over, you know, things that happen far away that will affect them. Like, her asking why are the adults behaving in such a crazy way is not a ridiculous question.
No, and we're seeing a lot of young people ask those same questions today. And so I think that there's a lot of power in that sometimes we forget as adults, because we either know too much or we're worried about what people might think. And then, of course, adults, too, ask these questions. It's not that we don't. But there's something really pure about the force of a young person questioning something that seems completely insane. And so I wanted to try to capture that. And as I was writing, I didn't realize that some of these things would resonate today, and maybe the way that they do, as far as how quickly things can become divided. Certainly the experience of being a refugee is something that is very present today. And this, of course, is one very particular experience, but that's kind of the point, to humanize this one particular experience and understand that anybody who's sort of given that label of a refugee is just a person going through a horrible experience. And this was hers.
My guest is author Veera Hiranandani. She teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence and has a new novel out for young readers. It's called The Night Diary. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Veera Hiranandani. Her new book is called The Night Diary. It tells the story of a 12-year-old girl, Nisha, who, along with her twin brother, her father, and her grandmother, have to leave their home in what is now Pakistan after the partition of India, and go to India, where Hindus like them will be welcome. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. The other thing I really liked about this story, Veera, is that we read it all in the moment. Not only is it a diary, but, like, as an adult, I have the sense that this family will eventually make sense of this, maybe recognize the ways that this experience has shaped them. As we are reading, though, it's all in the moment, and Nisha has no idea what's ahead or whether this will all feel like it makes sense at some point.
Yes, and that was tricky. As a writer, I like to put some kind of boundary, give myself some kind of rule before I start writing. Sometimes it's a bigger boundary, when sometimes it's just simply a point of view. You know, I'm doing this all in first person present tense or something. Mm-hmm. But this, of course, was in the diary. I thought about it. My editor and I talked about it. Do we want to ever step outside of this voice? And maybe she has another narrative voice. Will it control it too much? make it too close. And I tried it a little bit with a different point of view, and we really felt like it was stronger staying with the diary format. But so I really asked the readers to take a leap with me, because in the beginning she says, you know, I want to tell this like a story, and she doesn't know what's going to happen to her. Kazi has an idea. He gives her the diary. You know, he says you should tell, you know, explain what is going to happen. So he has an idea that some things are going to happen. He doesn't know the magnitude of what's going to happen, and she really doesn't know. And so it was tricky to do that. And at times I'm certainly writing longer scenes with more dialogue than a 12-year-old girl would probably put in her diary. So that is the leap I'm asking the reader to make. And I hope that every time I sort of wandered into that more of a narrative style to give the reader a sense of what would be happening, to try to pull it back and remind the reader that this is a diary and it's happening right now. And that was also tricky. There were times where I would sort of get confused, like, well, could she have known that? I guess she has to be saying it the next night because it happened yesterday. There were all these time things that I was working with in the diary that were complicated, but it really forced me to make choices in a way that I never had of how I was going to show what was happening in real time or, you know, just the day before.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Jabe on the line in Houston. Hi, Jabe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I joined the conversation a little late, but I was just going to ask Ms. Nandani if the partition was inevitable or was it stoppable, and a take on the leadership, like we talked about Gandhi, how about Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah?
Thanks for your call. Those are big questions
Sure.
you've thrown out
Yeah.
there.
And I don't really take that on in the novel. I honestly don't know if it was inevitable. I think that because I tend to see the best in everyone, I truly feel that both Jinnah and Nehru did not want violence, obviously, and just wanted to make sure that everybody was equally treated and had equal power in the government. And also all of them, and I'm talking about Gandhi and Jinnah and Nehru and Lord Mountbatten, they all had their egos involved and were making decisions based on many times what would give them maybe the most power or flatter them the most. That was a part of it. And then the part of it, I think, was just wanting to do right for the people that were looking up to them. So I don't really take a side in that sense. I do think that it was a very rushed decision and the lines were drawn by the British. And I do think that that time frame and who was drawing the lines was a mistake. But I don't, you know, ultimately, I don't know if it was inevitable or not. I really don't.
I'm curious about your father's candor in talking about his experiences. What this family goes through, and we won't give all the details, but it's really, really hard for them as they're making this crossing. They end up having to make it on foot. There's not, you know, there are real concerns that they won't make it. Did your father try to sugarcoat any of that for you simply because he knew that you would empathize with him?
I don't think it wasn't so much really a sugarcoating as just sort of telling it in this very bare bones, simple way.
Uh-huh.
Like, yes, we had to move, you know, might have been the first way I had heard about it. Oh, you had to move. Where did you move from? That kind of thing. And I would ask questions. Well, we had to move because of this. And, you know, the countries were being split apart and we had to find a new place to live. Oh, you had to find a new place to live. What place did you find? You know, and then as I asked questions, and this is really over years, or I would hear people talking about it at a party or a family gathering, and I would hear my uncle say something to my father about another piece of history or another relative that was, you know, I have more distant relatives that did suffer from more violence. And I would hear a bit of, oh, somebody had a knife pulled on them or something else. And I would be stunned, like, oh, that's not, I didn't realize it was that dangerous. And then maybe my father would tell me more. And so as an adult, when I sat down to write this book, I told him, please try to remember everything you can, everything you can. And we had many conversations about so many details. You know, I remember him telling me about the sand in the new apartment that they found this small new apartment in Jodhpur when they lived in this large compound in Pakistan. And my grandfather, like Nisha's father, was the head of the Mir Prakash City Hospital, and they had this nice compound. And then they moved to this very tiny apartment in Jodhpur, and there was sand and ants on the floor when they first came in. And my father remembered that detail, you know. And so those details I put in the book, and they were like gold to me, those very specific details, because certainly as a child, that's what you remember. You remember the sand and the ants, not so much the greater historical significance of the time.
What were your favorite primary sources besides talking to relatives? Like, were there things you discovered? Were there contemporaneous accounts of, like, young people explaining what their experiences were?
Did I talk to young people?
Or did you find things that they'd written, or did you talk to people other than your family who
sure.
had been there?
Yeah. Sure. I did talk to some friends and friends of friends, but mostly I researched in books and online. There's a book called The Other Side of Silence, which talks about a lot of personal accounts. There's this amazing effort called the Partition Archive of 1947. I think I'm saying it in the right order, .org, which is basically preserving these personal histories, because people in my generation, I think, were realizing in all different ways that, you know, my father is 80 and he was 9 when he went through this. So anybody older who remembers it in even more detail is in their 90s or not here anymore. So we're going to lose the people that can tell these stories. And I think these are stories that the people who really went through, especially very dramatic, violence things, are not that excited to revisit them. And so I think that's part of why they haven't been preserved. But now they're being collected on this archive. So I listened to hundreds and hundreds of people telling their stories. I was so grateful to have that. And there's also the first museum, partition museum in India now, that I think was started about a year ago. With a woman or two women, I think, my age, also interested in preserving the history, and not only all the pain and violence of the event, but in these kind of times of war or just an incredible crisis, there are amazing stories of kindness that I think need to also be focused on, because that's kind of where human beings triumph in those times when they can help other people, when they can just get past whatever obstacle they're facing and show that kindness to other people in the face of so much suffering and fear. So I hope that continues.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The story also made me think. I think the lasting takeaway is how things that seem permanent are not necessarily so, right? It's like an illusion to believe that what has been true will continue to be true. People die and societies fragment and leaders rise and fall. And it's up to us to sort of figure out how to continue being ourselves through all that change.
Absolutely. And I think somebody like my father, who's really been through something like this, and anybody who understands what it feels like to have your world completely turned upside down very quickly, knows how fragile society can be, and many of us don't. And I think it's a good thing to really understand and be aware of, because then we'll work harder to preserve what we want to.
And it's, you know, every generation of adolescents will also take on this challenge of finding an identity despite change, even like, you know, quotidian change that happens in everybody's life.
Yeah, I'm continually impressed by the strength of all the young people around us, you know, fighting for what they believe in. And Nisha is somebody in the book that she really doesn't understand how brave she is to just be able to get up and keep going. And I don't think you have to be in this incredible crisis with your life at stake to be brave in that way, to just get up and face whatever obstacles you have to face, and to keep going and to keep that hope alive is a very courageous act, especially for young people. So I hope that people do take that away from the book.
Did you work out the rest of her life just for purposes of preparation as you were writing this story?
No.
Really?
I didn't. I think that I've thought about it more since the book came out. You know, what sort of happened to Nisha? I thought about her life maybe the next year, you know, in the sense. And I sort of fill it in with my father's family and basically how they started a new life and then eventually went to Bombay, and then eventually came here to America. And so I think I've sort of filled it in with my family's history. But I think Nisha's doing great.
What was it like to hand a copy of the book to your father?
It was very moving. You know, my father, he's not an effusive person. He's a very kind of 2 + 2 = 4 kind of guy. He has an engineering background. So he just looked at me and he said, "I'm very proud." And that's big from my dad. And I think he was really surprised at how interested I was in his life and this piece of history. Hmm. So I just wanted to honor it and honor everyone who went through it, because it's something that I haven't been able to stop thinking about. So that's why I needed to write this book.
Author Veera Hiranandani teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence. Her new novel is called The Night Diary. Veera, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Twitter at KERATHINK. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast using any app that you subscribe to all your other podcasts on, but also check out our website, think.kera.org. There you can find a stream of the show, archives of the show, and information about what we have coming up. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.